Conservatism is a distant cousin of cynicism. Jonah Goldberg is here today to explain why that's not nearly as bad as it sounds. Uncommon Knowledge, now. Welcome to Uncommon Knowledge. I'm Peter Robinson. Be sure to visit our website, by the way, at hoover.org/UK. hoover.org/UK. With me today, Jonah Goldberg, a columnist, scholar, I know that that's an especially good scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, and the founding editor of National Review Online. Jonah Goldberg is the author of the best-selling book, Liberal Fascism, The Secret History of the American Left. Jonah's new book, due out this spring, is The Tyranny of Clichés. Jonah, welcome.
Great to be here. I love the slash you give
on
the UK thing.
I can never remember whether it's this way or this way, but it's a slash.
Yeah. As a student of European fascism, I will tell you that it did think of some of the forgotten gestures of the old days. But anyway.
All right. Star Trek, isn't it?
It's original Star Trek Klingon, but we don't need to get into this.
All right. What conservatives believe. Jonah Goldberg writing in the current issue of National Review, quote, conservatism is a distant cousin of cynicism. Explain yourself. You expect to sell magazines with that?
One of the basic differences between, as Thomas Sowell of Hoover would say in one of his great books, conservatives have a constrained vision and liberals have an unconstrained vision. And one of the things about conservatism is that we can be idealistic, we can be ideological. I don't think ideology is a bad thing, I think it's a good thing. I disagree with a lot of old conservatives about that. But our idealism is always tempered with the basic understanding that human nature is flawed, we are built from the crooked timber of humanity, that we can never, in the words of Eric Vergelin, I wouldn't be doing that.
Well, I did call you a scholar.
I can't do the National Review stuff and talk about this stuff without talking about immanentizing the Ashkatan. conservatives don't believe that you can create a heaven on earth, that you can make the here and now as good as the hereafter. And so one of the great things about conservatism is that it's always concerned with e-utopias, which is the good society, as opposed to utopias, which Thomas More coined that word, and it's a neologism, literally meaning no place. Mm-hmm. And so the cynicism is one of these things that keeps conservatism in check and lets us be focused on the doable and the good rather than the undoable and the perfect.
From the same essay, quote, the left's problem is that it has no limiting principle to its idealism, which means?
Which means that because they are utopian, right? Think of them as the donkey with the carrot hanging from the stick. You know, they never catch the carrot. There's always more to be done. There's never a moment at which they say, mission accomplished. Let us now go back to do the important work in the Burkean little platoons of our lives and do the things that keep a society healthy. Instead, there's always the next bigotry to topple, the next thing as we climb up this hill towards a perfect society. And so, you know, you can never say with, you know, this represents itself in more pragmatic and earthly ways, too. Bill Vogelie's great book on this, called Never Enough. There's no limiting, he argues that there's no limiting principle to what they think government can and should do. I'm one of these guys who actually argues that it's liberalism that is far more dogmatic than conservatism, and that the only, the fundamental dogma that defines liberalism is that government should do good where it can, when it can, whenever it can. And they leave it to the experts on their own side to decide good on a case-by-case basis, what's good for the cause, good for the movement, good for make them sleep well at night. But there's never a sense of the cause ever ending.
So there was a famous moment in the early Cold War that Robert Conquest writes about when somebody, it may have been Harris, some American said to a big-time Soviet, I think it was Litvinov, can't remember. But the question was, from the American to the Soviet, if we met all your demands, what would happen next? And the reply was, you would get our next set of demands. And you're saying that Nancy Pelosi would be forced to answer forced by her ideology, by her caucus, to answer the same way. You could not sit down Nancy Pelosi and say, if you could have everything you wanted, here, write it all down, what would it be? Where would it end? And she would not be able to give you an answer to that question.
I think there's one question you've begged here, one assumption that you've made.
All right.
Is that you would get an honest answer out of Nancy Pelosi. Because I do not...
The Soviet maybe, Nancy Pelosi
That's
never.
Right. I think Nancy Pelosi, you know, this is where the pragmatism thing comes in. It is perfectly fine. What is it under Islam, there's this theory of you can have a truce for a little while you get ready to have a war again. It's okay to say, here's my list of all demands, this is all we'll ever want. And then once you get them, ta-da, come out with another list of demands. Right. But yes, I think that if you could put her under hypnosis and say, you know, is there ever enough? She would say no, because it's there can't ever be enough, because there will always be some injustice out there and all the rest. And what the conservative mindset can appreciate is the fact that we'll never get to perfect, but you can get to good enough.
All right. The President of the United States.
What's required is a new Declaration of Independence, not just in our nation, but in our own lives, in our own hearts, from ideology and small thinking, from prejudice and bigotry, from selfishness and narrow interests, an appeal not to our easy instincts, but to our better angels.
And your attitude is, oh, go ahead, appeal to the easy instincts.
No, I have no problem. I have no problem. If you want to go against prejudice and bigotry and small-mindedness,
be my guest.
That's fine. Let's go after sleepy, grumpy, and dopey next. I mean, these are sort of silly abstractions to declare war on. What I find offensive there is Obama's insertion of ideology in that list.
Independence from ideology.
Right. Because what they're always talking about when liberals talk about how they're talking about ideology or labels or any of these kinds of things is they're always talking about your ideology, right? They're always talking about your inconvenient labels. I hear this all the time from people who say, you know, we need to move past our partisan differences. We need to move beyond this ideological divide. We need to get past these philosophical squabbles. What I've never heard, and I only hear that from liberals, right?
Right.
What I've never heard from any of them is, you know, we need to move past these ideological differences. We need to move past this partisan divide. And so therefore, in the name of getting stuff done in Washington, I'm going to abandon all of my principles and agree with you. They only ever say that stuff when they want you to shut up and get with their program.
But, Jonah, last question in this segment. Russell Kirk, one of the great historians of the 20th century and a major sort of a founding figure in the conservative movement of the 20th century, quote, conservatism is the negation of ideology, which sounds very similar to what Barack Obama was trying to say. Independence from ideology.
Yeah.
You think they're both wrong?
I do. I think Russell Kirk actually is quoting another fellow, H. Stuart Hughes, when he said that. But he sort of said it so much it became his line after a while. I have quite a few lines like that myself. The problem is if you go back and you look, and I agree with all the things that the conservatives who said they were against ideology, I agree with them with what they were against, right? Because basically the history of conservatism since Burke is the war against Jacobinism,
right?
There's this virus that was spilled in Robespierre's lab, you know, 200 plus years ago, and it escaped and it infected the minds of men and set their minds afire and aflame and all of the rest. And if that's what you mean by ideology, I'm against ideology. But that's not what I mean by ideology. What I mean by ideology is simply a checklist. It's a checklist of your principles. It is a way to put things in context. What's important to you? And this is a very practical thing. I measure political movements and political leaders not by what they say, but by what they prioritize, right? People say, well, libertarianism is about a lot more than drug legalization. And it is. And I know a lot of libertarians who don't care that much about drug legalization. But as a political movement,
that's always number one on the
list. It's always what gets people to show up. It puts butts in the seats. And similarly, so my idea of ideology is that it's merely an orientation to say, does this expand freedom? Does it protect individual liberty? You know, it's how you can sort of take in new facts and think about them and try to figure out what's important to you. It doesn't mean you ignore reality. It just means if you don't have some sort of filtering mechanism, it's just what William James called a bloomin' buzzin' confusion.
Segment two, Church and State. Two quotations. December 2007, last presidential cycle, Mitt Romney. Quote, let me assure you, that no authorities of my church or any other church, for that matter, will ever exert influence on presidential decisions, close quote. June 2011, this presidential cycle, Rick Santorum, quote, the understanding of the world that my Catholicism gives me, the world as it should be, an understanding of human nature and the ordering of our common affairs, that is important to me as a public official. Being religious and my being consciously Catholic is something to be proud of, close quote. Romney, here's my religion, here's me as a candidate. Santorum, you can't separate the two. Which do you find more persuasive?
The latter. I mean, I think, if Romney is taking orders from the bishops of the Mormon Church, that's bad. If Santorum is taking orders from the Catholic Church, that's bad. But beyond the sort of physical manipulation, I mean, beyond the sort of direct exertion of authority over somebody, where, you know, basically someone is being manipulated, the idea that somehow you can keep someone's religious faith out of their actions just strikes me as utterly implausible. You know, you can't say, if someone was an orphan and then grew up to run for president, you'd say, well, my childhood experience was really important to me. Well, if someone was raised in a certain church and takes their faith seriously, that's going to be important to them too. And why you can't factor that in as a voter or anything else and say, hey, look, this guy is pro-life because he's Catholic and and the motives don't matter. It's the positions that matter.
Okay, so that's a weak form of an argument. That is to say, people are shaped by their religion. We ought to have an honest discussion about it. So the next step, the stronger form of the argument would be, and that is a good thing. Do you say that?
Yeah. No, I mean, I don't know how you can avoid that. I mean, look,
You could say, well, one way or Santorum, we have to talk about Santorum's Catholicism. I'd rather not to. It's distasteful. I wish it weren't the case, but we have to talk about it. That's one way of putting it. The other way of putting it is, look, this guy's, he'll tell you exactly how the teachings of his church inform his political views. That's wonderful.
Well, let's put it this way. Candidates have an obligation to explain what they're going to do.
Right.
And if a candidate is going to explain what they're going to do, invariably what's going to creep in there is, why does he want to do it?
Right.
And if he says that the reason why I want to build public schools is because I'm a Catholic, that's fine by me if it's smart to build the public schools, you know?
Right. Okay.
And that's all it is. Getting obsessed about the motives about all this stuff, I find pointless to a certain extent. I mean, I am for a strong national defense, even if the president is an atheist or if he's a Satanist. The positions on the policies don't really matter. It's helpful to know where these guys are coming from, and I think there's no reason why they can't say that's where they're coming from.
Newt Gingrich.
And finally, many of you may have noticed that the Obama administration has declared war on the Catholic Church and other religious institutions. I want you to know that on the very first day, I will sign an executive order repealing every anti-religious act of the Obama administration as of that moment.
War on the Catholic Church and other religious institutions. Fair statement, acceptable if you give a little leeway because that was primary night in Florida and everybody's spirits were high even if he'd lost.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you don't like it. You know you're uncomfortable with that formulation.
Look, Newt contains multitudes. And and he is, I've been calling him in columns now for a while, Newtzilla. You know, I mean, rah, that's how he sort of approaches these things. And so... do I think it's a war on religion? Yes and no. I think that definitely within liberalism, this goes back to, you know, my stuff from liberal fascism. Liberalism or progressivism, however you want to call it, what it shares with a lot of the other isms of the left is this totalizing vision that Zbigniew Brzezinski and others, they defined totalitarianism as societies where there can be no islands of separateness. Mm-hmm. Every oar must pull in the same way. The Nazis used to talk about the Gleichschaltung, which meant coordination. It was a term borrowed from electrical engineering. And when you look at how progressives want religion to be treated in America, right? If you take the intellectuals who are honest and serious about this, they want to get rid of the tax breaks, or tax-exempt status for religious institutions. They, you know, we just saw recently with Obama saying that the Catholic institutions have to allow for coverage of birth control and all that kind of stuff. They don't recognize that religion is an island of separateness from the progressive cause. And so, in that sense, they are at war. The important thing in the culture war, the thing that the left never wants to acknowledge, and that is, it seems to me, incandescently true, is that they are the aggressors. Now, sometimes they've been on the right side. You know, when they were at the forefront of the civil rights movement, conservatives were wrong or too slow in joining in on that for a while. One can say that they were right on the big picture about feminism, you know, while at the same time they've gone too far, and we can have all those conversations that we've had a million times. So I'm not saying necessarily that simply because they're the aggressor in the culture war, they're always wrong. But they are always the aggressor. And they brag about it. They say they're the forces of progress. They're the ones who want to extend their vision to the every nook and cranny of society. And what drives them batty is resistance. When VMI says, no, we'd like to stay all male. When traditional institutions want to keep their rules, their religious rules or other rules, you know, men's clubs or whatever, they are the aggressors in the culture war. And to that extent, allowing for a lot of Gingrichian license, he is right in that Obama is the titular leader of the forces of progress in America, or progressives in America. And these decisions that he makes are consonant with that longstanding effort going back, you know, 50, 100 years.
Okay. Practical political implications of that. As you know, this is a kind of commonplace of American politics, Catholics in this country have been traditionally associated with the Democratic Party. Reagan changes that pattern and it snaps right back under the Bushes that the Catholics tend to vote Democratic more than Republican. Now listen to this, which is just a week or so old. His Excellency David Zubik, Bishop of Pittsburgh, writes the following in the Diocesan Newsletter, Pittsburgh. Quote, "It comes like a slap in the face. The Obama administration has just told the Catholics of the United States, to hell with you. There is no other way to put it." Close quote. Are we going to get some shifting of the allegiances here?
Well, that depends a lot on Catholic leaders, right, who have to be willing to actually put their money, as it were, where their mouths are. I mean, the better sign in some ways of how contrary-wise or cattywampus Obama is with Catholics was that E.J. Dionne wrote a column for the Washington Post.
Even E.J.
With his dress over his head about how Obama had abandoned Catholics on this and betrayed progressive Catholics. And, you know, if you've lost E.J. Dionne, who do you still
even
have?
Even the bishops have to start thinking twice. Okay, so let me ask you this. This is before this whole issue broke. Last summer, Gallup found that whereas 52% of Democrats seldom or never attend religious services, 62% of Republicans attend church or synagogue at least once a month. Mm-hmm. So it looks as though you're getting a sorting out into the party of God and the party of unbelief. Mm-hmm. Is that healthy for the country?
Probably not. But who are you going to blame? I think it's not healthy. But at the same time, if you have the party of unbelief making huge strides, it only makes sense that the party of God would rally in a sort of antibody response to fight that process. And I'm in favor of these sorts of battles being fought. I mean, it's just because it's ugly to say that that politics is being divided along religious fault lines doesn't mean that the people on the religious side of that fault line should surrender or give up the fight. And it will be awkward because what you're going to get is some extremists or some partisans or some true believers who, never having had to sort of think of their politics in religious terms, may go too far in defining their politics in religious terms.
Right.
And that could be a problem.
Right.
But on the whole, there's a reason why It's been called the Leave Me Alone Coalition for the last 40 years. The Republican Party, the conservative movement, is a creature that feels put upon by the left and the government, and for having its views imposed upon it. And I don't think they should lay down just because it makes our politics more ugly.
Segment three, diversity. An open letter to the Los Angeles Times. You know where this is going already. Quote, the greater Southern California community.
Of which you are a part.
Well, Northern.
You're a Northern, yeah.
Yes, the Northern California community.
You're the heathens, yeah.
Is one that not only proudly embraces its diversity. You can type it, but you can't read it. One that not only proudly embraces its diversity, but demands it. I am now forced to carefully reconsider which sources can be trusted to provide me with accurate news and opinions. Your new columnist, Jonah Goldberg, will not be one of those sources. Close quote. Signed,
Barbara Streisand.
Explain.
Okay. This is really truly one of the highlights of my career. And, you know, in many ways.
Where do you go from here?
Exactly. I mean, I should have just walked off the stage. Thank you, everybody. It's been great. And picked a new career because it just, you know, you're supposed to always leave on a high note. When the LA Times picked me up as a columnist, I was one of a bunch of columnists.
Which is, what, 3, 4, 5 years ago?
Oh, it's 2005.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's been a while. When they picked me up as a columnist, they also picked up a bunch of others, but the others were not nearly as unpleasant.
Uninformed.
Unpalatable.
Undiverse.
That's right. And so it became this thing because they got rid of Robert Scheer, who was one of these longstanding gargoyles on the parapets of the left, you know, and replaced him with me. And the irony here is that I went and looked it up, you know, so Barbara Streisand has this thing where she thinks diversity, you know, it's almost as stupid as that line from the movie Anchorman, where Ron Burgundy thinks diversity is an old wooden ship. She thinks diversity just means good things, right? It means hearing more voices I already agree with. That's what she thinks is diversity in her media. And so when they replaced Robert Scheer with Jonah Goldberg, basically an old Jew with a younger Jew, you know, my demographic profile in every other way is, you know, he's of Scotch, he's of German-Jewish descent. I'm mostly German-Jewish descent. I mean, all basically the same creatures, you know, biologically. What's different is we have different political views. Robert Scheer is basically an ideological tutor to Barbara Streisand. Mm-hmm. And so Barbara Streisand's interpretation of what diversity means is hearing stuff that reinforces the views I already believe. But she can't accept that having me on board actually makes the views of the Los Angeles Times more diverse. And I've always found it as this great sort of example of how the left continually uses a lot of these words, like social justice, diversity, to just mean good things. And the irony is that the policies that they enforce or they pursue basically are the antithesis of diversity.
The great stronghold of diversity, the modern university. Lee Bollinger, president of Columbia, quote, diversity is not merely a desirable addition to a well-rounded education. It is as essential as the study of the Middle Ages, of international politics, and of Shakespeare. Diversity broadens the mind and the intellect, essential goals of education. Close quote. What the heck was wrong with that?
Other than the fact that it's incredibly stupid, there's nothing wrong with it, right? I mean, look, I'm in favor of diversity depending on how you mean diversity, right? I mean, obviously, we don't really make, when people say diversity makes things stronger, sometimes they're right, right? A mixed portfolio is a stronger portfolio than one that is invested entirely in pets.com, right? A gene pool that is diverse is healthier and more capable of resisting disease than one that has been inbred over a long time. But an NBA team that is well populated with midgets and one-legged women is not as strong as, say, an all-male team. And my problem with the way Bollinger frames this is what they're really doing is they're saying that diversity is a key educational tool so that they can make racial quotas and affirmative action, all that kind of stuff, permanent. Right. Because once you say it's as essential as Shakespeare, well, you're never going to get rid of Shakespeare. Well, so why never? Yeah, that's right. But, you know, for the purposes of his propaganda, right, you're never going to get rid of math. You're never going to get rid of Shakespeare. You're never going to get rid of diversity. But the thing is, it's just not true as a factual matter. I mean, Aristotle didn't come up in a very diverse community. Socrates, Einstein, all of these people didn't. And meanwhile, the policies that they pursue on these college campuses under the rubric of diversity actually lead to balkanization. You have the Black Studies Center. You have the Hispanic Studies Center. I've probably visited 60, 70 campuses in the last 10 years for speeches and whatnot. And everywhere I go where they really push diversity, you go to the cafeteria and you see a bunch of Black kids sitting with Black kids and Hispanic kids sitting with Hispanic kids. You have dorms divided by race sometimes. I mean, it is the idea that somehow you are exposing kids to a diversity of views by playing these games, I think is just at minimum not proven.
In my own observation, I haven't been to as many college campuses as you have, but I know what you're talking about. My own observation is that there are two places where diversity actually works in the way that, say, Martin Luther King would have hoped that it worked, where kids actually even forget about racial differences. Those are the athletic programs and the Greek system, the fraternities and sororities. And those are precisely the two that the modern university is placing under constant pressure.
Yeah.
The one place it works.
And ROTC programs.
I mean, that didn't even occur to me because it's so entirely outside civilized discourse. So why? You can make the argument that because of the racial history of this country, we have to engage in affirmative action. But you just pointed out that that's not the argument here. The argument here is a kind of preemptive act of aggression, intellectual aggression on the part of the Lee Bollingers of the world. They're trying to set themselves up to say, even after any argument for affirmative action has long since ceased to resound, has lost its validity, we will insist on racial and ethnic diversity. Why?
Because they like it. And because there are institutions that are fully invested in it. And I like the idea of a colorblind society. I have no problem.
But that's not at all what they're saying.
No, I know. That's sort of the problem. But if you have these criteria by which you're allowed to organize society, sort of like the Minister of Populations under Stalin, right, where you can just sort of move people around and make everything aesthetically pleasing and look like a Benetton ad, that gives you an enormous amount of power. And so the diversity thing, you can make the argument about African Americans and Indians, I suppose, right? That these are historically
Native Americans.
Native Americans,
right.
Not Indian Americans. Indian Americans.
We may have to bleep that out.
Indian Americans are the new Jews. These kids are buried in guilt and hyper-educated. But you make it about Native Americans and African Americans because there's a specific historical context to it. But even that specific historical context certainly doesn't justify Barack Obama's daughters getting special treatment because of their race.
Right.
It doesn't explain why so many of these universities are filling their racial spots by importing Black students from Africa. But what you get is, it was amazing. When I went around a tour of Washington, D.C. private schools, because I'm not going to send my kid to a public school in Washington, D.C., it was amazing. Almost all of the private schools thought their comparative advantage was to prove that they were more committed to diversity than the other school. It wasn't just that we believe in diversity, which I to a certain extent, okay, that's fine.
Apart from anything else, an admissions officer who fails to Google on Jonah Goldberg should be disqualified immediately.
Well, we went to one school where the headmaster came in and was talking, it was an open house thing, and said, I want you to go read the mission statements of these other schools you're looking at. These are important things. You'll find a lot of code words in there. Things like academic rigor and values. And we want to be very clear that we consider diversity and social justice to be easily as important, if not more important, than all of those other things. And that is a mindset that's out there. It's sort of on autopilot.
Yeah.
And it's going to be a while before we put the genie back in the bottle.
Segment 4, the middle class. Have you read Charles Murray's book yet, Coming Apart?
I've leafed through a bunch of it.
So Murray's argument, as I understand, I haven't read the book yet.
Yeah.
I will. The top 20% of Americans, those who send their kids to private schools in Washington, continue to exhibit the virtues of hard work, religious belief, and traditional marriage, but the bottom 30% have over the last few decades ceased to do so. I now quote our friend David Brooks in his review of the book Coming Apart in the New York Times, quote, the word class doesn't even capture the divide that Charles Murray describes. You might say the country has bifurcated into different social tribes. Close quote. Is the middle class gone?
No, I don't think it's gone. But you were, I mean, what Charles documents, from what I can tell very well, is that basically the whole society was going to hell in a handbasket, right? And it was going into a nosedive in through the 60s into the 70s. And
meaning the top 20% and the bottom 30% and everybody in between was shedding the traditional values
that's
of
right.
hard work and marriage
right. they
and
were,
religious.
They,
everybody was throwing it over the side.
They're bailing out their social capital off of both sides of the ship.
Right.
And as they were going into this nosedive, not to mix the metaphor too much, the top quintile, however you want to put it, realized what a disaster this was and pulled up.
Some people wised up.
Yeah.
In time.
And too many other people kept going down. And one of the reasons why, I mean, I don't know if this is Charles' argument, but I think he would agree with this. One of the reasons why is simply that the wealthier you are, the more you can afford to learn from your mistakes. And, this is one of the things that always, drives me crazy about Madonna. You know, Madonna is one of these characters from my youth. In the 1980s, she was this huge symbol, pop icon beyond belief, the Elvis of the 1980s in some ways. And she glorified, she represented what I would call slattern chic, right? This idea that you can just, if it feels good, do it, and all this kind of stuff. And of course, she learned from her mistakes, and then she became this family woman and and this super mom, according to People magazine and all those kinds of magazines. And she could afford to do that because she had tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars.
She has nannies to take care of the children.
Her nannies have nannies. Right. I mean, she has entourages of people. She once told in an interview that she doesn't have any problems changing diapers because she's never changed a diaper. The problem is that the people in the lower and middle lower classes who followed her example, if they made one mistake, if they had a baby out of wedlock or if they just went, too far or whatever, they didn't have the resources to rebound from those kinds of mistakes. And I think that that's one of the things that we are seeing, is that we're seeing a sort of unraveling. It's very difficult if you don't have the resources, emotional and otherwise, and financial, it's very hard to pull out of that nosedive. And, Irving Kristol always used to say that there was nothing wrong with this country that a good recession wouldn't fix. And I'm beginning to think he was wrong, because we've been in a pretty good recession, and you haven't seen a sort of hunkering down and reacquainting of the people with these sort of traditional sort of bourgeois values that you might
hope.
You
don't think the Tea Party represents Go ahead.
I do. I think the Tea Party is a very healthy thing. I mean, I've been saying for a long time now that the Tea Parties are essentially sort of a stem cell therapy response. Extremely healthy. They helped the Republican Party regrow a spine, and that was a very good thing. And I think at the same time, you look at the Tea Parties. I've spoken to a lot of Tea Party rallies and whatnot, and you look at the Tea Parties, and they're older, they're more established.
They're the top 20%?
Not necessarily. I mean, I think you make
a good
point.
They're the 50% in the middle
who can see
their kids going either down or up? Or
yeah, but I mean, then you I think the Tea Partiers are probably smarter than the Occupy Wall Street guys, but I would bet you that the Occupy Wall Street guys are far better credentialed in terms of their education. And the Occupy Wall Street people think that, the Constitution needs to be rewritten so that they have a right to an iPod.
Okay. Two clips. You tell me which of these two has a better feeling for what's actually happening in the middle class in America and for what needs to be done.
Okay.
This is the defining issue of our time. This is a make or break moment for the middle class and for all those who are fighting to get into the middle class.
By the way, I'm in this race because I care about Americans. I'm not concerned about the very poor. We have a safety net there. If it needs a repair, I'll fix it. I'm not concerned about the very rich. They're doing just fine. I'm concerned about the very heart of America, the 90-95% of Americans who right now are struggling, and I'll continue to take that message across the nation.
Well, obviously, look, I'm a conservative, and therefore I'm more in favor of the Republican Party than the Democratic Party, which is not to say that I define myself as a Republican. I define myself as a conservative. But so I would think that Mitt Romney has better instincts about this. or better policies about this.
But on the evidence of that clip?
On the evidence, I mean, that's why I'm being coy here. Is I think on the evidence of that clip, Mitt Romney is just an incredibly frustrating politician.
Fine. We'll let it go at that. Segment five. Jonah Goldberg writing on The Corner on National Review Online. Two quotations, both of them from you.
Okay.
One, quote, "The conservative establishment has become vastly more conservative over the last two decades. It's more pro-life, more pro-Second Amendment, more opposed to tax increases." Quotation two, "Gingrich is making Romney a better candidate, but not good enough." Close quote. Conservatives becoming more conservative, and yet it looks as though the Republican Party, conservative party based in the South and mountain states, is about to nominate a Northeastern moderate. How can this be?
Oh, who among us can contain their enthusiasm? It is a source of great frustration. I'm not so much anti-Romney as I'm sort of anti-pro-Romney.
I get that, actually.
It's the people who want to tell me that he is everything that we need and that he is this new Reagan and he's this full-spectrum conservative and all this kind of stuff. I don't buy any of that. And that's, in some ways, that's okay, right? I mean, I, in some ways, would like to move to a more transactional relationship with the White House. One of my great frustrations under George W. Bush was this way of so many people on the right defended him because of his culture war frequencies. You know, that because he was a Texan and he spoke the language of
He had all the right enemies.
Right.
He had all the right enemies, therefore it was our duty to stick up for him.
That's right. And I think a lot of conservatives overlooked a lot of battles that they otherwise would have had because his enemies were so terrible and it was a war and all the rest. And this has been my theory for a very long time, is that the Tea Parties in many ways represent a delayed backlash against Bush and a delayed backlash against being forced to vote for John McCain. And
So Tom DeLay and Denny Hastert are up there on the Hill spending and spending and spending, and conservative pundits said, la, 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 I don't want to hear it. I'm not seeing... Right.
Well, okay. In my own defense, I complained.
Not you. Yeah, not you.
I started saying, I think, in 2003 that George Bush was spending money like a pimp with a week to live. And, you know, I don't even know how to describe what's being spent now. But
But that was the phenomenon. That's what you...
Absolutely. Okay. That was the phenomenon. And there was a lot of this stuff about compassionate conservatism, which I always hated. You know, my last name's Goldberg. I'm sort of an Old Testament guy. I like my conservatism with more smiting and wrath. And I always found compassionate conservatism to be this invidious slight against conservatism. You know, put any other label in there. I'm not a, you know, Bush would say, you know, I'm a different kind of conservative. I'm a compassionate conservative. Okay, well, imagine how offended you'd be if I said, you know, I'm a different kind of Catholic. I'm a compassionate Catholic.
Right, you know? Right, of course.
And so I think there are a lot of people who were fed up with a lot of that. And then when Obama comes into office and he hits the accelerator in ways that made Bush look like, you know, Calvin Coolidge, things just blew up. And the problem now is that they feel like the establishment, whatever that is, screwed them. And they feel like Romney, who they don't like, or they don't love, and they really want to love somebody. I don't think they hate Romney that much.
How could anybody hate him?
Exactly.
Obviously a decent human being.
Right. Vanilla is everyone's second favorite flavor. And so they don't hate him, but they don't love him. They really want to love someone. They want to be in love with a candidate. And they've had these sort of tawdry affairs with everybody else other than Romney for this entire primary season.
Go ahead. Finish that thought, but I want to ask a question about that. Go ahead.
Yeah, and so I think you get to this. So now the problem is that these people, there are a lot of people there. I hear from them every day, and, you know, God bless them, and they're wonderful people, and I'm basically, my heart's with them. But they have this conception of the establishment of the Republican Party as if Lowell Weicker and Nelson Rockefeller are still calling the shots.
But you can understand. Okay, hold on. Let me put the question to you this way. Look at this field.
I agree.
Look at this field.
I know.
Just as you said, conservatives have become more conservative. There's a feeling of remorse for not standing up to the spending under George W. Bush. And look who's running. So isn't it natural for somebody to say in the country, this is such a bizarre field. Mitt Romney is the strongest candidate, and the conservatives have people to choose from who include Newt Zilla and the others, Herman Cain, who's wonderful, and then drops out.
Yeah.
Somebody must have done this. this is such a bizarre result that somebody, somewhere, must be pulling strings to make this happen to us. You can understand the impulse, don't you think?
I can understand the impulse, but that's a terrible impulse. It is a terrible impulse. To ascribe to the chaos of life the intentionality of people in some star chamber is a really unhealthy way to go.
Okay.
But at the same time, I completely understand the frustration, especially when you see this great bench that the Republican Party has, where they're all sitting there, you know.
So let me ask you then, you can go candidate who might have been by candidate who might have been. Mitch Daniels, by all accounts, his family just didn't want him to do it. And when it came right down to it, Mitch Daniels said, my first duty is to my wife and daughters. And who can gainsay that? And on you can, well. So, is it simply that it just happened to tumble out this way, or has the GOP or the nation now set up a combination of nominating procedure with an overlay of new media that just makes every sane candidate take one look and say, my wife doesn't want me to do this? Well, is there something systemic rather?
Yeah, I don't think so. I think this was just really, really bad luck. Okay. And just on a point of clarification, you know, Cato Byrne makes this point often. When these politicians say...
Cato Byrne, your colleague at National Review. Your irresistible colleague
Irresistible. She's now the head of the National Review Institute. And she gets fed up with when politicians say, I can't do it because of my family. You know, and she was an Army wife for a long time. And her point is, you have these 22-year-old kids, these 18-year-old kids, going off, fighting, sometimes dying, leaving families behind for our country. And if you believe what these politicians say about how the country's going to hell and needs to be defended, we need to change these policies, and then they say, oh, by the way, even though I have $1 million and a wonderful house, you know, but my daughter, you know, has tennis lessons and I have to, you know, there is a disconnect there that's problematic. On the other hand, I'm a big softie about my family and I understand that. In terms of the luck thing, I think basically the big part of the problem was that you had Tim Pawlenty and Mitt Romney soaking up the moderate, and to a lesser extent, John Huntsman, who really sort of nailed down the Mandarin-speaking vote in the Republican primary. But you had Romney and Pawlenty, and Pawlenty got in very early and announced very early that he was going to spend big money and have big organization to defend the space of 3 feet to the right of Mitt Romney. And I think that is one of the things that discouraged a lot of people who would have to get into that space, you know, the Mitch Daniels and all of those guys. And then it turned out that this idiotic Iowa straw poll, I mean, this incandescently stupid straw poll thing, in a ridiculous caucus state to begin with, completely blew up.
Goldberg at nationalreview.com for all our viewers in Iowa.
I love Iowa. I think the Iowa caucuses are idiotic. Right. But
so you are making the point that there is a procedural nonsense in the middle of all this.
I agree there are systemic problems, but I don't think it's the system. Yes. You know, or anything like that.
Okay. So Tim Pawlenty, but you are genuinely making the case that Mitch Daniels and Jeb Bush and Chris Christie were chicken of Tim Pawlenty?
To a certain extent, yes.
You are.
Yeah. No, I am. Let's take it back. Okay. So who is this conservative establishment that wants Mitt Romney?
I sort of assumed you were a member of it.
It's amazing.
That's certainly the first name that pops into my mind every time I hear the phrase.
For months, I'm getting this email from people saying, you know, your hero Mitt Romney, you're in the tank for Romney. And I challenge them to show me a single paragraph I've written that would support this claim. It doesn't exist. But look, I think by acclamation, people would agree that Bill Kristol, if he's not the president of the conservative establishment, then he is certainly, you know, the standing secretary or the treasurer of
it. Bill Kristol, editor of the Weekly Standard.
A Weekly Standard, and a great man, a good friend, and all the rest. But Bill Kristol has been doing everything short of walking around naked with a sandwich board and a bell, screaming for somebody else to get into this primary. And yet everyone says, oh, the establishment, you know, Bill Kristol and all these people, they want Mitt Romney. I don't think anybody has been dying for Mitt Romney to get in, but Mitt Romney wanted it. He's fought for it. He showed he has the fire in the belly in a way that these others haven't. And, my point about him for a while now is that he sort of speaks conservatism as a second language, so it comes across idiomatically really messed up. But he clearly wants this, and he's been running for it for a very long time. And no one else had that fire in the belly that at least was a plausible guy to run. And I personally think it's a shame. I think he might make a fine president. He might win it, but...
Win the nomination or win the presidency?
Win the presidency.
All right. So you think he, as we sit here today on February 2nd taping this show, it's all but a foregone conclusion that Romney will become the nominee?
Close to that. Very close to that.
Close to that. No chance of a brokered convention, or the chance is 1%? I mean,
look, any pundit who says they know what's going to happen next after being just beclowned over the last 6 months by this process needs to have their head examined. But
all right.
It looks that way.
Aside from your best-selling books, make the preemptive presumption that The Tyranny of Clichés will become a best-selling book as well as Liberal Fascism.
Oh, I appreciate that.
So aside from these objects printed on paper, you have 30,000 Twitter followers, you have a Facebook page, you have an email blast with tens of thousands of subscribers, you're a founding editor of National Review Online. How has the new media changed the conservative establishment? How has the new media changed the job of the political pundit? Let's put it that way.
Oh, well, first of all, to correct one thing, I don't have a Facebook page anymore because I hate Facebook. And I've taken to calling it Satan's urinal. But on the other fronts, I think one of the things that's frustrating for me is, and I say this purely as a guy who's trying to put food on the table, is that the new media environment has completely commodified column writing.
Yeah.
And you know, people forget that, you know, people think the internet killed newspapers. Well, the internet basically just finished them off. Newspapers have been dying for about 60 years, and the process has accelerated and accelerated. And so, as a business proposition, regardless of any grander analysis, it's just very bad for this business. There's never going to be again a Walter Lippmann, a William Sapphire, a George Will, a Charles Krauthammer, a columnist who sort of owns some real estate and changes opinions and all the rest. And that, I think, is probably healthy for society, but
bad for business.
But it sucks for me. And so these are sort of problems. But I think in the general, one of the things it's done is it's made the conservative establishment, which again, a term I find ludicrous. I mean, to me, the conservative establishment is basically defined by the people who compromise, who accepted their disappointment too early with the Republican field. But it has made the conservative movement vastly more democratic, vastly more transparent.
It enabled the Tea Party to come into being.
It changed the personality, at least the public face of National Review, which has been this flagship of the conservative movement for a very long time. You know, I mean, the magazine still hews to a certain tradition, the print magazine, but National Review Online is read by more people than the subscribers to all the political opinion magazines combined.
Right.
And it has been for a very long time. And I think that's all to the good. I mean, I think in many ways what's happening is, you know, you had basically this strange parentheses from basically the beginning of the New Deal until about 1982, let's say, where the, or 1989, of the American people being willing to sort of be spoon-fed their information from these elite big institutions in the media, you know, the big three news networks, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the LA Times. That's going away, and that's good, right? The American people, because of the New Deal, because of World War II, and because of the timing of the arrival of live television, were used to sort of essentially, for want of a better word, falling in line and taking orders from their media elites. We are now going back to what was the norm in America, and is still the norm in Europe, of a more partisan press, where...
Tocqueville's America.
Tocqueville's America, right? And Tocqueville talks about this at great length. He says, you know, the key to America is association, and the key to associations are newspapers.
Right.
And so it's whether it's the Daily Kos, or Red State, or National Review Online, or the Huffington Post, these are serving the same function that newspapers served in the 19th century, of forming communities where people can get together, get the information that they want to get.
And it has the advantage of a certain fundamental honesty.
Yeah.
People who write for the Huffington Post don't have to pretend that they're being impartial. Nobody would suspect them.
Right.
In their wildest imagination, you wouldn't accuse them of impartiality, nor would you accuse anyone at National Review Online of impartiality. They're very partial people.
Yeah, that's right.
And they explain why.
But I've argued this for a very long time, that opinion journalism, the good reported opinion journalism is the best journalism in America, for the simple reason that, you know, if you take something that Ramesh Panuru always likes to say, that he, my colleague at National Review, right, and I'm convinced a Vulcan, Ramesh likes to say, I want to go after the left's best arguments, not their worst ones. And he sets forth in a fairly lawyerly way of laying out their best arguments and then trying to take them apart the way a lawyer would. Now, lawyers, you know, defense lawyers and prosecutors in a court of law, we know they are not impartial. The prosecutor wants to put the right accused in jail. Right. The defense lawyer wants to keep him out of jail. But they have to address the other side's best arguments. They have to address the relevant facts. And they have rules about honesty and all of the rest. That's what a good opinion journalism, whether it's on the left or the right, that's what it does. It says, this is where I'm coming from. This is why you should agree with me. This is why the other side says I'm wrong. And here's why they're wrong. And that I find so much more pleasurable to read, whether it's coming from the left or the right. I mean, a good, really good piece in The New Yorker making a case for something,
right,
so much better to read than some allegedly objective garbage that you might find in, you know, in a 10-part series in The New York Times.
Last question. A word of advice, then, for a member of the Tea Party who feels terrible, who feels your frustration with the field, and who feels, as you feel, that the chances that Mitt Romney will be the nominee are very, very good, and that somehow or other this is at a minimum unsatisfying. What is your advice to that viewer?
Well, suck it up. I mean, seriously, I mean, you know, Barry Goldwater gave this, and I love the Tea Party. I'm not trying to be dismissive of it, but this is life. This is the situation that we are in. You know, we can have huge arguments like little kids about wouldn't it be cool if Superman could fight the Hulk, right? But they don't get us anywhere. Barry Goldwater in, what was it, 1959? You might know this better than I do. You wrote a wonderful book about the Republican Party. The forces of Goldwater, the old forces of the Taft guys, were completely screwed by Nixon.
Right.
But Nixon gets the nomination in 1960, and Barry Goldwater gives this wonderful speech where he says, let's grow up conservatives. You know, because the conservatives were talking about bolting and third parties and all this kind of stuff. He said, let's grow up, conservatives. This party is our historic home. Let's do everything that we can for this party. And that is a simple fact of it, is that we have our two-party system. Whether that's wise or not, that is the fact of the situation that we are in. Third parties historically only screw the parties that they are more simpatico with. And if you honestly believe all the things that we've been saying and reading and thinking for the last 3 years, about Barack Obama and his agenda, then it is a simple no-brainer how to vote. And doesn't mean you have to like it.
You can force yourself to eat spinach. You can't necessarily force yourself to enjoy the experience.
That's right.
Jonah Goldberg, author of the forthcoming The Tyranny of Clichés. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. This was fun.
I'm Peter Robinson for Uncommon Knowledge. Thanks for joining us. Thank you.